The Outer Hebrides is the last ramparts of the Gaelic language, the Gaelic culture, of the ancient past. My father and my mother couldn't talk English. But there's only 80,000 in Scotland today that talks the ancient language of the Gael. What we are scared of, is that even what's left of our culture is going to be swamped by what's coming on the scene now, the onrush of oil and what God's to come in its wake. It's as near as that.
Probably one quality which the person from the islands has is something of the quality of the homing pigeon in many ways, in that no matter where you let him go, he ends up wanting to go back to his own home loft. Historically, people have had to go away. Many of them have wanted to go away for a while of their lives, but if you ask any of them, no matter where they are, where they would like to be, they will tell you in the islands, in the Isle of Lewis.
If the traveller or the homecomer takes the Sullivan across the Minch from Ullapool on the Scottish mainland, the first shipboard view of the double island favours the southern part, Harris. The treeless peaks soar higher. The land separates itself more resolutely from the shoreline. But Lewis recaptures your attention near land, because Lewis has Stornoway, the main port, and it presents itself admirably. A shorefront row of stone-faced shops and hotels, and a town hall that somehow manages to combine Victorian frivolity and Calvinistic severity. The only disturbance to the eye sits on the nearby point of Arnish, seemingly a gargantuan garage, but more of that later. The ship is close enough to see the people of Lewis and Harris, separate equals. Lewis men Kenneth Smith, and Norman MacDonald, and Harris woman Morag Mackenzie.
Harris is different probably from Lewis in that Lewis has Stornoway, which is quite a big town, so that probably everything centres on Stornoway, whereas in Harris you tend to have a whole lot of small villages. The pace of life certainly is very much slower and gentler than in Lewis.
The Harrisman is much contenter person, and I've often wondered if it has anything to do with the dull, sort of uninteresting terrain of Lewis, that people feel, well, we must get away from here and do something more positive. Whereas in Harris you've got beautiful hills, lochs, and sea inlets, and I think this has something to do with that marvellous sense of humour that they develop.
Even the appearance of Lewis people, I think, sometimes is different, because you see a great many tall, fair-haired Lewis men. What Harris people tend to be smallish and dark, generally. Must be the old picked bloodiness, I think.
I have very little difficulty in Lewis in placing Lewis people once they speak, and especially if they speak in Gaelic, because I think the Gaelic dialects are very, very distinctive. For example, in Point, and then going across to the west coast and to a more isolated area, you come to the Uyghurs, and they, oh, nesh, 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 oh, whale, hammy, kitch, kivelin, coolish, oh, hackajara. And then you can go over the border from Lewis right into Harris, and there you come, I think, to a very much a richer kind of voice, and to my way of thinking, I think a much pleasanter form of Gaelic. And you listen to a good man from, say, Scalpe or Tarbert saying, oh, nice, evel do la coupain a golden bechish in the Jew, or nach boy o heen of bah.
Oh, Bochen lein, tannen lein, bochen lein, mesue. 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 Tannen, 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 tannen.
In my time, when we first went to school, most of the kids with me at school were Gaelic only. They had to learn English when they first came. I was perhaps more fortunate in that my father, being a minister, English was used in the manse to a very large extent when visitors came, and he instilled the very good habit of conducting family worship in English one night, in Gaelic another night, and we were taught to read both languages as children, so that we had really that advantage over the local people. Nowadays, family worship has, as you probably know, died away altogether, or to a very large extent anyway, and we find children now coming to school with no knowledge at all of reading, or no ability to read in Gaelic.
Can you hear me? Translated into English, Kenneth Angus McKeever, Assistant Director of the Highland Society. The association came into being in the 1890s, when people realised that Gaelic was not being given a fair deal, either by successive governments in the country, through lack of teaching of the language, and generally by implication more than by active thought, word or deed, trying to destroy the language.
In recent years, there has been an upsurge of interest in Gaelic, a sort of a new attitude towards Gaelic, and the Scottish Education Department, for the first time, have shown that they're quite prepared to accept Gaelic as one of the languages, one of the subjects to be taught in schools. And there's a greater freedom in the use of Gaelic. At the time of my father went to school, Gaelic, in fact, was banned within the school itself. In my case, I can teach Gaelic, as I do myself, and there are more books on the market. But I think the new interest stems, I think, from the spread of tourism. To a very large extent, it is the learners of Gaelic who have, I think, brought in this new interest. And gradually, some of the local people are beginning to see that Gaelic has its advantages.
It is probably not so concise a language as English, in that thoughts and things which can be dismissed with one word in English need a few words to describe them in Gaelic. But with these few words, I think the sentiment behind it, whatever the feeling is much more accurately described. And in fact, this is what many people who try and learn the language find difficult.
You have a tremendous variation in vocabulary. If you take the word for just an ordinary towel, a hand towel, now, in Lewis, you would call this item tuelch, which is just a corruption of the Gaelic word towel, tuelch. But go down to Harris, and you'd find the same article referred to as sheraeter. Now, there appears to be no connection whatsoever between these two words, but sheraeter is a very, very pure and old Gaelic word for this kind of item.
To give an example of these various shades of meaning and adjectives and this kind of thing, this is a verse from one of the most famous Gaelic poets, Duncan Ban MacIntyre. I'll have a go in Gaelic first of all, and then I'll do the English bit. So, Viulade Luchnoch Liam Chluasoch, Glas Chrenyanoch Chun Garant Neloch, Sifath Glan Uchtard Gilimanoch. I find that difficult to translate, to say, because it's not, you wouldn't do it nowadays. That means, there's the aquatic, sleek-eared watercress, grey-green, round-headed, tender, dimly blue, growing clean, high-breasted, dandy-like, beneath its white, complete, peculiar crown. Where one adjective could do, you know, about half a dozen were used. So it really was, in the days gone by, a language of poets.
Falche er Skaltine Kelterk, program in Landu, or in Nyilan. This is a VHF Gaelic broadcast for schools.
Angry and worried, not to honor, pass, Today's theme, entitled Songs of the Islands, explores the descriptive powers of selected Gaelic birds, writing in praise of their native islands.
In the Hebrides, we have our own very special brand of songs, although perhaps the range is in a way limited. One thing I find with the Hebrideans, they have a marvellous sense of humour. And something interesting happens, or something amusing happens in a village, and you find that the village poet, within a matter of a day or so, has composed a song to commemorate this. And I would ask myself, does this come down from the old tradition of the clan bard, where you had the clan appointed their bard, and it was his job, of course, to put in song, poem or poetic form, the achievements of the clan chief, and the battles he fought, and this kind of thing. So that now you have in villages in the Hebrides, you have the local poet who... I'm thinking of people particularly like Murdo MacFarlane of Melwurst. Now, Murdo is in his 70s, an ordinary crofter, retired just recently. He was a storeman at the local aerodrome. But Murdo's quite capable of writing a song about, say, an incident, something that happens perhaps in the harbour. Two boats collide, and there's an awful row about the loss of the cargo or the loss of the fish. And two or three days later, you find not Murdo, but somebody else from the village reciting this song, but with a sort of smile on his face, saying, "It's not really mine, you know who's done this."
What I do is I snatch items out of the civilization which I saw. You see, I'm in a unique position at 74. The civilization which I was born into and grew up, I won't die in it. The civilization which my father and mother was born into, they died in it, but I won't. It's a completely new civilization now. Now, what I endeavour to do is snatch something out of the past civilization of what I saw and put it to music so that the coming generation will know that such a thing existed as people cutting seaweed with a seeker. This is a seaweed cutting song. No. I composed Malamar, that is the toll of the sea. The sea, as we know, is a cruel sea. To give you an instance of how cruel the sea can be, a year last November, I think, a young fisherman was drowned. He was married to a relation of mine, and I knew the lad well, and his parents very well. And of course, I called at the old parents. It was a small village, and that was the third drowning that year. But what she told me was this: the only time I ever saw my father cry, and he was a big, strong, husky man, the only time I ever saw him cry, having tears in his eyes, was in a New Year's morning in 1919. A ship had sank in at the mouth of the harbour in Stornoway, the Ayrlair. Her father had gone early to see what happened. How did the village fare? She said, "We saw him coming across the hill, and my mother met him, and she asked him in Gaelic, 'Jeet the Nayok, what is your news?' He said, 'The two Ians are drowned, that's two brothers, in the next house.' But she said, that wasn't the end of it. There was only 23 houses in the village. but there were 11 wakes in this small village that very night. That shows you the toll people pay to the sea.
Anna tarach von kleine foim na tarach gart hat horen a hun mar hol es lang sen am fast kun mohe kun ros es loj rikane Anna tarach gwon, kleine foim na tarach gar.
Well, I've been fishing for over 2 years now, but previous to that, I spent 20 years deep sea in the mercantile marine. Travelled pretty well every part of the world, from Japan to the States, and you name it, I've been there. This is quite a change, but I like it very much. The usual fishing is prawn and whitefish, and we usually spend, at the maximum, maybe 3 days at sea at a time. We usually leave home on the midnight Sunday and finish up on the Friday evening about 6 o'clock. That's our usual week's work, providing we don't get held up by weather or anything like that.
Fishing today is a pretty expensive business to run. All the marine electronics you've got to carry aboard the boat, and fuel costs, maintenance costs, of course, they're very high. Today, I suppose, £1,000 to rig out a boat for fishing. In the past, well, I'm not very familiar with it, but I've seen the boats here. And it was mainly drift net fishing they were doing here under sail until the latter part, just after the end of the war, when there was a few ex-Navy MFVs came and they were rigged out for long lining. Till about, I suppose, maybe about 15 years ago, they started on the bottom trawl. And so it's developed up to the modern day, where they're working pair trawls and purse seines. The largest be about 3-4 miles long and about 200 feet deep. And the ship just tracks down the herring with sonar and encircles it, and then draws the net into a close, just like a purse, and the herring is sucked out. In other words, it's got absolutely no chance.
As it is today, it's maybe too modern. The fish don't have much hopes now. With sonar and all the new stuff they carry, it's...
And the herring that comes into the Munchier comes from the North Atlantic, and, of course, up until the time it reaches the 12-mile limit, it's under the threat of the Norwegians and the Danes. They're all working the purse seine there. By the time it reaches here, really very little.
I think within a few short years, the stocks will be run down to nothing at all. So the future doesn't look exactly bright at the moment.
My name is Bill Scott, and I'm a fish merchant. I'm all for the 50-mile limit, and that's... It's certainly not a selfish attitude we have at all, but we just want to preserve what we have. The foreigners there, they've gone and ruined their own grounds, and they've taken an awful lot of herring and fish out of the Munches, and I fear that if these foreigners continue to fish out here, there'll be nothing at all landed here. Those foreign ships just go straight to their home port, and we certainly won't have any fish or reserves of any kind to keep the industry going.
I would hope to carry on fishing, but I'd like to get a bigger boat someday when if things improve here. I get maybe 3 or 4 years more out of this boat and maybe buy a larger boat then.
Unless my son gets married, he's the only one I've got, so it's up to him now. The ball's more or less at his feet, so I can't say much about that.
I would think I probably would be fishing for the rest of my life. I think the bug has got into me now.
At the mouth of Stornoway's outer harbour is the rocky point of Irnish. Here in the spring of 1746, Bonnie Prince Charlie hid from his seekers and watched the lights of Stornoway anxiously Mrs. Pilot tried to hire a boat in town to take the royal fugitive to France. Today, the Arnish landscape is utterly changed by a sprawling complex of structures designed for the manufacture of equipment for pumping oil from the North Sea. Lewis Offshore Limited Stornoway is a subsidiary of Fred Olsen Limited London, in turn controlled largely by the Aker Industrial Group Norway. In short, international oil-related industry has come to Lewis. Small beside those on the eastern Scottish mainland where the oil waits offshore, but large enough to transform the economy and the lives of the Lewis folk.
My name is Donald Macaulay, and I have been recently appointed convener of the Western Isles Council. As I see the situation at the moment, with the advent of the oil business, I think we have the first opportunity in the Western Isles we've had for 1,000 years, if you like. The parish where I was brought up in the island of Lewis has exported every graduate it has produced for the past 300 years. Now, this is a sad thing to say. It's always the people with ambition, the people with a drive, an initiative and an impetus. They are the ones to go away first. And they would be the ones that would contribute most to their own community if they had employment there.
As far as money is concerned, we're needing it into this island. But in a way, I feel it's going to be a big change. There's too many of the foreigners coming in, and they're taking over the place as far as homes. And when we were growing up, we never needed to lock a door, because different people lived in the island, and now it's all going to be changed, all these strangers coming in, because we don't know where we are.
Well, I'm not worried about this. In the first place, we're insisting here that out of the 1,000 men who will eventually work at Arnish, that about 600 to 800 will be local people. So we will only have perhaps about 200 incomers. People who are worried should remember that during the war we had equal numbers or more of servicemen here, and we managed to cope with them quite well. We've even coped with the Vikings, and we've coped with the five adventurers who came here in the 16th century to take over the place, and we coped with them quite well. I don't see why we can't cope with a few hundred gentlemen at Arnish, even when they do go out on a Friday night.
If thousands were sighted in Stornoway, that would have a tremendous effect. But if they were divided and a site made over in Carloway, say, another site in Ness, and now that would relieve the situation, because educational-wise, the schools at the moment here are bursting at the seams.
The impact of a big industrial project like Olsen's in Stornoway has already been considerable, but it has been tactfully handled. They are a good developer. They have adjusted themselves to certain old-fashioned traditions, like the great reluctance of people here to work on Sunday, which seems to us in other parts of Scotland to be carrying things to a very considerable extreme. In other parts of Scotland, Sunday working, as and where required, is perfectly acceptable. But here, it's a long-standing tradition to the contrary.
The Sabbath is very precious, really, to us here. And in fact, the community is very keen that any of the oil-related industries that set up here should not take away from us the peace and the quietness of Sunday. So I understand that is written into contract something to safeguard us against that encroachment upon Sunday as we know it. Because still here we retain the old Scottish Sabbath and work ceasing and people going to church.
Kent hartet be in food with all what spirit
I am Angus McCoish, and I've been minister here since 1950. I'm in Stornoway here in the Church of Scotland, and I've got two kinds of services every Sunday. There's a Gaelic service and an English service. In Gaelic, we sing nothing but psalms, and it is a precentor who leads the singing.
Thank you.
One thing that strikes a stranger hearing Gaelic church singing for the first time is the tunes seem to be different from anything he has known, but they are actually the same tunes which we use as we use in singing English psalms. But somehow or other, the tempo is slower. With this technique of presenting every line, there seem to have been introduced certain grace notes, and it takes quite a while for a person to realize that these are the very tunes he's been used to singing in English all the days. Of course, this I suppose, goes back to the days when people weren't able to read and when they didn't have copies of the Bible in their hand. There was the presenter, sometimes I suppose to be the local schoolmaster, and during the service he would lead the singing, and each line before it was sung would be presented by the presenter. He would, as it were, chant the line.
The social scene for the young person in Lewis at the present time isn't particularly an enticing one. We're in the middle of a kind of a dilemma at the present time, from the day when everybody made their own entertainment to the way they see life in the big city, where they can go out anywhere and get entertainment and pay for it.
When I think of when I was a boy in what we called the Cayley House. The Cayley House was a gathering house in a village.
They used to have one Cayley House, usually, to which people went. It was usually because the lady of the house or the man of the house had a particularly pleasant personality, was a good storyteller. And everybody, all the young people, used to congregate in that house. But nowadays this goes on more or less only at New Year time. Everybody comes along and everybody more or less has to sing or to play or to do something, except very untalented ones like myself who sit and listen. The time when one hears old songs, which have been handed down for generations. You hear some of the older men singing songs at New Year time, which you never ever hear at any other times. But probably way back you would hear this almost every night. This is when they learnt them. I know this is when my own father learned a great many of his songs. It was from attending Cayley's when he was young, and he still remembers quite a lot.
Now, there was something unique about the Cayley House. It didn't really belong to the people of the house 100%. I'd seen these Cayley houses full up to the door, but nobody belonged to the house who'd be in. I've seen the man of the house coming up from the barn to the kitchen, and he would find that there was no place for him to sit there. But he wouldn't say to anybody, get up and give me a place to sit on. He'd take his shoes off and sit at the front of the bed, and he'd lit his pipe and he'd sit there. Now, here's a man content with very little of the materialistic things of life.
I'm Mrs. McCaskill, and I'm chairman of the Social Work Committee of the Western Isles Islands Council. The old Cayley House, as such, has disappeared. I would say that possibly both the improvement in the internal part of the house and television have really abolished the Cayley House. No longer can people walk in with their big boots or their Wellingtons and sit down on the wooden bench and gather around the peat fire, because whereas there was a clay floor before, there's now either a very highly polished floor or a carpet. And naturally people say, well, I'd rather not come in, and business is done on the doorstep. Perhaps there's a tendency to overemphasize the house as opposed to it being a home as it used to be.
One place that still presents a friendly welcome clutter is the croft, a small rural landholding. And the rhythmic clack of the man-powered loom inside the small stone house still sounds like it's saying things are never too busy to stop a while. The Lewis crofter has tenure on his few acres for a nominal sum a year, a throwback to the days of the giant Scottish clans when the chieftain assigned property to the clansmen and the land was used to the full. Today, a few sheep may graze on the croft. A small garden patch may grow on it, but probably little else. The crofter more likely is indoors, in a shed attached to his house, at a foot-powered loom, weaving world-famous Harris tweed.
These looms are made in England and there. When we bought these, they were about £36. Now they're about £300, I suppose. That's the difference in the price going up. And they're still the same loom, still the same. There's no change in them since 1936, I think. It can weave anything up to half a dozen colours in the tweed. You can do a tweed as wide as 40 inch. I've been doing it except during the war year since I was 15, and that's 40 years ago. And I don't mean to drop it now because there's nothing else I can do. Years ago, they used to do it all by hand then. They used to take the dye, crottle they called it, off the stones and boiled it some way or the other and dyed the wool with it. Then they made the wool themselves into yarn, usually brown tweeds that in these days. Piece of that used to last a lifetime to anyone who got it. They still do it over in Harris, everything by hand. But we're weaving for the mills here.
The Kenneth Mackenzie Tweed Mill in Stornoway, a family business for most of the century, managed today by Harris Mackenzie, the grandson of the founder. Big business in a world market. James Shaw Grant is chairman of the Crofters Commission, a part-time member of the Highlands and Islands Development Board, and chairman of the Harris Tweed Association.
Harris Tweed was made traditionally in all the islands. It came to be called Harris Tweed because it was from Harris that it was first marketed commercially.
Harris Tweed is definitely by far the biggest industry in the island. And this has been the case since the early part of the century. My own grandfather, Kenneth Mackenzie, built his first mill in 1906. This was the first carding and spinning mill which marketed Harris Tweed. And the wool that we buy from mainland producers is processed by us to the various shades that are required to match up with the designs that are ordered by the particular customer. And it is our responsibility to deliver the prepared warp and weft for weaving to the crofter weavers daily at their own homes in the island of Lewis and Harris. These crofts are scattered throughout the whole island. And we have an agreed collection date. The product is then taken back to complete the remaining processes of washing, milling, which puts the body and the handle into the cloth. The cloth then is examined by our own examiners. The cloth then is passed to a separate department, which is run by the Harris Tweed Association examiners. These people police the cloth and cover all processes. And that's more or less the end of the process from our point of view. There have been many changes over the years, which are natural. There have been marked changes in the world textile markets. The present cloth is 28 to 29 inches wide. Double that width, say 58 to 60 inches wide, there would be a considerable advantage from a making up point of view. It would be cheaper from a making up point of view, less wastage. There are other avenues open to us, of course. The ladies' business, which is limited because of the width of the fabric. The difficulty here is that hand weaving on a single width fabric is one thing, but producing a double width cloth of twice the width is another matter. At the present moment, it would appear that the physical effort involved would be just too much for a weaver. Peddling twice the weight is quite a problem.
The particular feature of the industry is that the weaving is carried out by the islanders at their own homes, so that it is still genuinely a crofter industry. Now, we are in the process of considering, nothing has been decided, but we are considering the possibility of asking the government to amend the trademark to permit the use of power under properly controlled conditions, which would preserve the cottage character of the industry as far as possible, while permitting more sophisticated machinery. The market for the single width cloth is declining rapidly, so that the weaving force has been reduced by approximately 50% in the last 5 years, and the spinning strength has been reduced by almost 50% in the same period, so that unless action is taken, there's going to be a very serious slump in the Harris tweed industry.
If you did have big business coming in, I think it would have to be an industry which would give employment to islanders, but one which would not give you this feeling of rush and dust and hurry and destroy, this feeling of togetherness which one has at the moment.
What we are scared of is, you see, is that even what's left of our culture is going to be swamped by what's coming on the scene now, which, of course, we know could be a boon and a blessing. That would be all right with strong cultures. But with a weak culture such as we have, we are in a weaker position to withstand the onrush of what's to come. It's as near as that.